Get your films on with the Blurgs.
Once an idea has taken hold of the brain, it's almost impossible to eradicate.
Unpacking movies has never been more spot on, woke, fire, and just plain lit.
They are lit all the time.
So if you're unsure whether or not to plop down some cash for a film, check out the Blurgs.
When a man with a 45 meets a man with a rifle, the man with a pistol is a dead man.
Brando's got what plants crave.
It's got electrolytes.
You really only need to hang, mean bastard. But mean bastards, you need to hang.
Don't say you weren't warned. Ridiculous. Here's Brandon and Jeff.
Hello and welcome to another First Look episode of the Film Blurgs. I'm Brandon Norwood, a.k.a. Hero Protagonist, a.k.a. the True Father of Joe's Kids, a.k.a. Poppy Chulo, a.k.a. the Glizzy King, a.k.a. Mr. Krusty, a.k.a.
the Lethal Protector,
a.k.a. I want a Subaru Outback so I could have mad strippers in the back giving shape-ups, a.k.a. my biggest pet peeve is sports. Why? Because I don't like seeing grown men sweat on each other, a.k.a. Ruff McGruff, a.k.a. These Nuts, a.k.a. B-Wood, the Magnificent. And I'm joined here today with my brother, Trey Norwood.
What's up, y'all?
All right, so let's jump right into television for what I have watched lately.
What are you watching?
All right, so this is the TV I've been watching. The Terminal List. The Terminal List is so far insane. It's 8 episodes. I'm like 3-4 episodes deep. This is pretty nutty. It's basically like a conspiracy thriller, like a military conspiracy thriller. Chris Pratt plays a military commander. His whole squad gets ambushed and, you know, it goes bad, this mission that they're on. So he comes home. Taking step by step, going through, you know, the detox process that they have to go through and seeing a psychologist and stuff. And basically everybody's trying to gaslight him, saying that he's crazy. And you'll see why by the first end of the first episode, why he's not crazy. This is a dark show. That first episode ends on a doozy of a cliffhanger, and it's a dark cliffhanger where I was like, wow, that's fucking, this show's starting off rough already. Antoine Fuqua directed the first episode, and it seems like Chris Pratt and Antoine Fuqua will probably be working together a lot going forward, which I'm fine with. You know, I think Chris Pratt is a fine leading man. I have nothing against him. I got nothing. It's like when he's in stuff, I know what I'm going to get. And here I'm getting something that I wasn't really expecting with Chris Pratt, especially with episode 4. Episode 4 has one of the craziest torture scenes I've ever seen in a fucking TV show or movie. That shit was gnarly. Goddamn, The Terminal List, it is on Amazon Prime right now. Go stream it. We'll get into the newest episode of Ms. Marvel. Trey, what'd you think of this week's episode of Ms. Marvel?
I liked it a lot. It surprised me like how they kind of flipped continued to flip the fish out of water aspect of the show, because they carried that over from America to Pakistan, which was really cool. And then seeing everything with Red Dagger was really cool too. I don't know. I feel like this week's episode did a lot, but also didn't do a lot in a lot of ways. Like, it did a lot for the character, I guess I should say. But for the story itself, it didn't really move things forward too much, which I was fine with, especially after the first episode was kind of more so of, like, just establishing everyone and everything. I feel like, for me personally, the show has gotten better with each episode as far as, like, what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I think this is the weakest episode just because I thought the directing and the writing could have been like much better. However, Kamala is such a strong character, and then these new characters they introduced, the Red Daggers, are so cool. This show's been a blast despite them changing her origin, and that's the thing that's a testament to these adaptations from Marvel, is like, even though they'll change like a character's origin or like how they end up in this cinematic universe, it is still true to the character itself. Like, America's origins change, but that's still America Chavez. This is still Kamala Khan, despite her not being an Inhuman. Like, yeah. I really have no complaints overall. I think the show could be, it's just this episode I just thought wasn't as good, but you do see the budget because she's in Pakistan, and this is a pretty big episode in Pakistan. I understand now why they're showing these in Pakistan in as a trilogy of movies.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see where we go with episode 5, because we leave off on a pretty unique cliffhanger in episode 4.
Yeah.
This is pretty cool. Yeah, I have no idea how this show is going to end. But, you know, I wish Ms. Marvel was getting another season rather than being put into a Captain Marvel sequel. Like, I understand, like, she's in the comics, too, and in this show, it's predicated that she exists because of Captain Marvel. But, like, oh, man, I don't know. I don't know, man.
It's interesting to me, too, how, like, two of Captain Marvel's, like, major players have been introduced in the TV side of things instead of being introduced in the movies. Like, I'm just now realizing that after listening to you talk, because not Monica, or is it Monica Rambeau?
Monica's her mom, because Monica does pop up in
the first Captain Marvel,
and she's in Multiverse of Madness, yes, as Captain Marvel, because Monica Rambeau was Captain Marvel before what's her face,
Carol,
and then Photon was also Captain Marvel. That's her code name. I don't know what her real name is. I can't remember what her real name is, but yeah, Photon, it was Captain Marvel, but it seems like she's just going to be going by Photon as of now.
Yeah. And that's the other thing too. People keep asking, like, is she going to be Photon or is she going to be Spectrum? I'm just like, but yeah, I think it's pretty interesting that they chose, like, cause those are pretty big characters that they chose to just introduce in TV, which it's not a complaint. It just seems like, oh no, it seems like a lot of the focus now does seem to be on TV, because the movie quality isn't really matching the TV quality.
Right. And not for nothing, both Photon and Ms. Marvel are much better developed than Captain Marvel. Yes. No offense. Carol's still a cool. I still ride hard for Carol Danvers, even though everybody shit on that first movie. I still ride. I understood what they're trying to do with the first movie. I just think it might have taken a better director to do what they were trying to do, that stoic fish out of water.
I agree with you 100%.
Because she was acting like an alien mostly because she's been off Earth for so long. Look, again, I would take Captain Marvel any day over most of what we got from Phase 4. I'll say
I
that
agree
much.
With you 100%.
Again, we're going to get into Phase 4 in the main review, because I know that's probably what most of you are here for. So yeah, Miss Marvel, I got no complaints, man. And finally, we'll talk about the old man for TV. The old man, episode 4 is very, very crazy. Like, now we're getting to the complicated character relationships that this show is slowly developing, now that it could take a breather in the action and just let us reposition these characters. And as these characters are, like, trying to reposition themselves and get themselves ready for obviously the next round of conflicts, it's a lot of maneuvering. There's the asshole CIA guy who you guys, if you've been watching the show, you understand, he's been, you know, he's not beloved by anybody. Yeah, he's still maneuvering. Man, we end on a very big reversal of position between Jeff Bridges and Amy Brennan's character. And I get where Amy Brennan's character is coming from. She should absolutely feel the way that she feels. However, it's just like, girl, I don't think you understand what you're doing here. Even he says, do you understand the gravity of the situation that you're doing right now? And yeah, man, it's It's crazy, but I'm very interested to see how this show develops. It got renewed for a second season already, so I'm interested to see how this show continues. I want to read the book that this is based on, because I have no idea where this story's going. This is a nice action thriller, but it is my type of action thriller. It's slow burning. It's more focused on the characters. It's very realistic. I'm very excited to see where the old man goes. That's TV, so we'll move into movies. And for movies I've been watching, I saw Brian and Charles, which is basically this Irish comedy. And if you're familiar with comedy from England and the UK in general, you'll understand that it's very dry, very quirky, wacky, because it's about this social outcast named Brian who builds a giant 7-foot-tall robot named Charles. And it is the jankiest looking robot ever. Like, if you saw it down the street, walking down the street, you'd be like, oh, that's a fucking robot that I could probably push over and it'll probably break. Charles is fully sentient. It's just hilarious watching these two go together. But then, you know, it turns into it's typical where it goes. Like, you've seen this type of movie before. I would say wait till it hits streaming and rent it or whatever streaming platform. It'll probably end up on Peacock, on the cock. Yeah, I mean, fucking Brian and Charles. There's not much to say about that. I'll move into Roxanne. Jeff told me to watch this a while ago, and it's basically a Cyrano done in the 80s. And instead of Cyrano being like a dwarf, as he is in the most recent iteration, or disfigured, as he's known to be in other iterations, in this one, Steve Martin plays Cyrano with a big nose. He has a big, long nose. It's overly exaggerated. Yeah, it's well done. I mean, this story can be adapted and told in new and different ways and still be entertaining. I mean, I don't really have much to say because, like, it's kind of standard, but, like, it's well done. Yeah, man, I'm glad Steve Martin's back. I missed him because he's been killing it in Only Murders in the Building. Like, season 2 just premiered. And those first 2 episodes have been fucking crazy.
Yeah, I need to finish the first season so I can start season 2.
Yeah, season 2 is so far has been nutty. Yeah, that's all I got to say. I'm glad to see more Steve Martin, though. And even Martin Short. Those two, honestly, everybody in that show makes a great team. Like, I would never think to put Selena Gomez with them two.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that I noticed that she's also a producer on that show along with them. So, yeah, that's pretty cool, too.
Yeah, so moving on from that, I'll get into the final movie I'll talk about before the main review, which is, I can't even say this dude's name. He's from Thailand. Achapor Wichersaw. Sorry I butchered your name, my guy. He did Uncle Boomy. If you've seen Uncle Boomy, you kind of know what you're getting here. This movie's called Memoria. It stars Tilda Swinton, and she is a Scottish woman visiting her ill sister in Colombia. And this movie, so to give you some context, because I don't want to get further into the plot to spoil it, like, the movie's slow, like, really slow. It's an art house movie. It's really slow, but it's also unsettling and has you on edge despite it being PG. This movie will never be streaming. It'll never hit Blu-ray or DVD because the director wants you to see it in a theater. And it'll, the way they're neon, because this is a neon film, the way Neon is releasing this is that it'll play at a small indie theater for a week and then it'll move on to another theater. So, like, this weekend, it's playing like 10 theaters across the country. One of them just happened to be a theater in Princeton, the Garden Theater, one of the oldest theaters in the nation, believe it or not. Yeah, so Princeton Garden Theater got it. It's playing 3 times, only 3 times at the Garden Theater, which is wild that they get this movie and they're only showing it 3 times. So basically, at Tilda Swinton's character, she hears this loud noise, and it sounds like a giant metal ball hitting a giant animal skin drum, and it's unnerving, because that's how the movie opens. She's sleeping, and then you hear this noise, and it's just so loud, and like everybody jumped out of their seat, and that noise recurs over and over again throughout the movie. And by the end of it, you do figure out and you find out what that noise is. In context with the rest of the movie, it makes sense because the movie does do some strange, surreal David Lynch type things where there's a character that she meets and then this character just completely disappears and falls off the face of the earth. And then later in the movie, something happens with a different character, and then you'll find out that that's the same character. Like, I'll leave it at that. Like, it's to help you guys digest it, I'm going to give you that. It's the same character. Yeah, this is Memoria. It's basically playing off, you know, the perception of reality, hence the title Memoria. There's near the end of the movie, it all comes together where memory starts playing into the narrative. And as with the entire movie, now I understand why they want you to see it in a theater, is because it was shot on film. It was mixed in Dolby Atmos. There are 35 millimeter prints floating around out there. It's really the sound mixing and sound design is some of the most unique I've heard in a movie in a while. It reminded me of Roma and how Roma was mixed in Dolby Atmos, and seeing Roma in a Dolby theater, a theater equipped with Dolby Atmos, like, made that movie for me. This, I'm also wish I could have seen it in a theater that's equipped with Dolby Atmos, since it's mixed in Dolby Atmos. Like, there's moments of silence in here, and the silence is just so shocking. And then it'll cut directly to like a crowded street, and you'll hear like people talking in the background on the street and buses going by. And the way the movie's mixed, it's just amazing. Great sound design, great sound mixing. The noise, I'm gonna let you guys know, the noise is gonna come when you least expect it. So every time it happens, you'll be jumping out of your seat, because everybody was jumping out of your seat when the noise happened.
Listening to you talk about the sound design, it reminds me of, what was the Riz Ahmed movie? Was it Sound of Metal?
Yeah.
It seems to me that, like, if a lot of indie movies are going to want to start using Atmos, so they have the right to. I feel like indie theater should be given access to be able to have like Atmos installed. And honestly, I feel like Dolby should be the ones to install it, because none of those theaters can afford it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I agree with you. It's not fair. It's absolutely not fair. Like, even this will be playing at the Alamo Drafthouse next month in downtown Manhattan.
Okay.
If I have, like, I'm going to try and make it and see it there. Yeah, I agree with you. Like, even they deserve to have Dolby Atmos.
Because, like, it's all just part of the art form of filmmaking. So I really feel like each theater should be able to have the opportunity to be equipped with the best sound possible.
Yeah, because Roma, these are small movies. Like, Roma's a small movie, but it deserves to be seen in the theater. Because, again, Cuarón did some next-level sound design with that movie. Sound of Metal, I do wish I saw in the theater.
And that's what everybody says, because of the sound design.
Yeah, and it was released at the height of the pandemic when we're still in lockdown.
That's right, I forgot.
And it took me a while to watch it, just because, like, man, at that point in time, man, I just didn't. And that's why I thought the whole Oscar season that year was a whole fucking farce, just because I was like, I don't want to watch these movies, just because, like, I'm already feeling bad because the world's fucking shit right now. Yeah. Like, the only Oscar movies I watched were like Judas and the Black Messiah and Nomadland, and Nomadland swept anyways. Yeah, it's interesting. This was nominated for Best Foreign Film. It's this guy's first movie in English.
Oh, okay.
But most of it is in Spanish. Because Tilda Swinton's speaking fluent Spanish, which is impressive because I don't even know she spoke Spanish. And she's just speaking it fluently. But a lot of this is in English, but most of this is in Spanish. It was submitted for a best foreign film, and it didn't make the cut, which is a shame.
That's whack.
It is. I'm letting you guys know it is slow. There's going to be stuff in here where you're going to be like, why did this happen? But the more you think about it, the more it makes sense. It's one where you're going to watch it, just sit with it, give it 24 hours, and then you'll still be thinking about it. Like, there's still stuff to process. There's a lot of stuff to process. That's probably why it takes that's why I say every movie needs to be seen twice, because there's just some movies like this where you have to see it more than once to fully understand it, or to even, let's forget even understand it, but understand the director's intention or the story they're trying to tell. So, yeah, I have nothing more to say other than I'm trying to see it again. It's going to be hard just because I think this rollout is kind of janky. Like, they should honestly give it 2 weeks. A two-week run at each place and, like, multiple showtimes, because the Garden Theater is only showing it three times, which is fucking nuts. You'd think they'd give it, like, two showtimes a day for the week they're going to have it. Yeah, that's Memoria. All right, and let's move on to our main review.
And now, the moment you've been waiting for. The Film Blurbs feature film review.
Okay, so I'm going to start with Minions, because what? Fuck it. The 3D's cool. That's all I can say is, like, the 3D's cool. I love the first Despicable Me. That was the first movie from Illumination. I like the animation style. I like Illumination's animation style, but it's been looking bad since that first Despicable Me. And, like, everything they've made since then has just felt like, let's just make money. Like, Despicable Me was so creative and so well done. And then you get to all, like, Sing 2, Despicable Me 2, Secret Life of Pets 2. It's just, even the first Minions, I'm just like, I could say this about Minions, The Rise of Gru. It is Illumination's best movie since the first Despicable Me. It's structured weirdly because, like, the first act really focuses on Gru, and it's cool seeing Gru as a kid and just seeing this kid, like, hang out with these minions. It reminded me why I liked the first Despicable Me. But then after that first act, the movie kind of splits into two. So you're on an adventure with the three main minions from the first movie, plus a new one who has braces named Otto. And then you got Gru on his doing his thing. And I was just like, okay, this is weird. People were laughing. Everybody was laughing. I was just kind of sitting there like, yeah, man, I guess y'all like watching minions just do dumb shit. I did like the climax of the movie. That was cool. And if you've seen the previews, the climax of the movie, there's all types of creatures. The villains of the movie turn themselves into creatures, and then the minions fight the creatures. I thought that was pretty inventive and cool. And like I said, that's really, again, the 3D is great in this, and seeing that in 3D was great. Do I recommend you go seeing this in a theater? No, man. Like, you could wait till this hits the cock, or you could just rent it when it hits VOD. Like, this shit, it honestly is not worth paying money.
No, it's interesting to me why, like, Illumination has been as successful as they've been, only because, like, I know people love the first Despicable Me. I'm a fan of that one, too. I'm, like, one of the only weirdos in the world who likes the second one more than the first one.
You like Despicable Me too?
Yeah. Like, I like the first one. I didn't like the first one as much as other people, but I like the second one better. But even then, I like the second one as much as people I know who love those movies. And it's just, like, Illumination is such a weird studio to me, just because, like, they're so consistently successful, but I also hear them get dunked on all the time. Just because they constantly crank out, like, mid-tier to subpar content. And, like, and that's essentially what they treat it as content and not, like, films or anything. Because, like, I know so many art majors who absolutely despise Illumination just because they don't like the animation style. But you even pointed out that, like, they peaked with their first movie because they just don't want to be creative with it because they got to crank them out. Because they're owned by Universal, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, which makes sense.
It just feels like they're not. You could. It's fine to crank out stuff, but like if they're, it feels like they're not even trying.
Well, and that, but that's what tends to happen when you crank something out. It's like you have to put, you have to hit your deadline. You're not even worried about actually making something good. You're just worried about finishing it and hitting the deadline. And that's not to say that everybody at Illumination is not putting their absolute heart and soul into it. I'm sure they are. It's just, I feel like if they were given more time, they probably make another Despicable Me.
This felt like they tried, though. I'll give them that. Like, okay. This new one felt like they tried. As far as Despicable Me 2, I do like Despicable Me 3 better than 2.
I still haven't watched that one just because I'm so lukewarm on that whole franchise.
Yeah, man, because it peaked. Like you said, it peaked at the first one. You know what I mean? Like, they gave little fucking chicken nuggets, yellow chicken nuggets, their own fucking franchise, which is insane to me.
Because the first Minions came out before Despicable Me 3, right? Or did it come out after?
That's a good question. I'm going to Google that.
Because the last Despicable Me movie I saw was the first Minions movie. And that's why I jumped ship, because I do not like that first Minions movie.
Yeah, that first Minions movie is fucking terrible.
But, like, as, like, me and you were having a conversation about it not too long ago, how, like, the Minions have, like, grown beyond Despicable Me and Illumination itself to the point where, like, they're just their own form of entertainment, which is why this one's, like, making gangbusters.
So, yeah, you're right. That's the problem. Minions came out before Despicable Me 3.
And that's why I had no intentions of seeing the third one, because I was like, yo, they peaked.
yeah. It is what it is.
Exactly.
If when it's on TV, man, watch it, because it's there. You could do worse. It's only without credits, it's only like 1 hour and 25, and with credits, it's 1 hour and 27, and there's a mid credit scene.
I think everything going on with animation this year is fascinating, solely because it's just like, what are people willing to see animation-wise? Because, like, nobody wanted to pay to see Lightyear just because they've been trained to see everything Pixar and Disney+. People legit thought Despicable Me was going to cap at, like, $80 million this weekend, and it's on track to make $129 million. Like, and I don't know what other animation stuff has been coming out, but I've noticed animation's either been, like, overperforming or underperforming. And it's solely because of the pandemic and the nature of it. It's just because animation was keeping the film industry alive. Like, Scoob went straight to streaming. A bunch of those movies, Croods 2 went straight to streaming. All that shit went straight to streaming. So, like, it's interesting now just seeing what's making money and what isn't.
Well, it seems like there's more. The reason why this is making more money is because there's more adults seeing this than fucking families and kids. Like, there's more adults seeing Minions for some odd reason. Yeah,
and the ticket tracking leading up to this weekend even suggested that it was mostly just adults going with their friends or by themselves to see Minions 2, The Rise of Gru.
Yeah, I don't know, man. You have so much quality content in theaters, and y'all decide. That's what's crazy. Universal put out two fucking absolute garbage movies back to back.
Yes.
And these are the ones that everybody wants to go pay and see.
That's why I'm saying it's interesting to me, just because, like, it's saying a lot about, like, American audiences right now, especially, like, again, what's making money and what isn't. Like, Top Gun's killing it, but Lightyear, which is, like I said to you, like, Top Gun for kids, but with sci-fi, is literally bricking. Like, it just hit $100 million this weekend.
Yeah, man. And, like, Lightyear to me is just a cross between Star Wars and Star Trek for kids.
Yeah.
For fucking kids.
Yeah. Like, they even had some, like, they credited the person who did the math in the movie. Like, all the science is accurate, which is wild to me.
I think it's funny, too, that people hate Lightyear and they'll say, oh, Andy must have terrible taste in movies. And I'm like, bro, if I was a kid and I saw this movie, I'd lose my fucking mind, too. Like, I guarantee you, if there's shit that you love from your childhood, go back and watch it. That shit's not good. I went back and watched Power Rangers. That shit's not good.
Yeah, that's right. We watched that one summer. And Beetleborgs.
VR Troopers.
Yep, we watched
all that shit is not good. There's a lot of shit from your childhood where you're just going to be like, oh, this was not good.
Yeah.
And maybe sometimes navel-gazing nostalgia is just not good.
And you know what? I can't believe I'm saying this, but Tim Allen was right. Tim Allen came out and said, he's like, yeah, people aren't seeing Lightyear just because they can't get their heads around the fact that this version of Buzz isn't connected to the Toy Story Buzz. And he's right. That's literally what it is. It's that, and people just don't want to pay to see most Pixar movies in theaters anymore.
I mean, we'll see how long Disney lasts, because like I said, you can only ride two IP.
Well, homie who said he wants everything to go on Disney Plus just had his contract renewed for 3 years, so.
And that's why I'm saying, let's see what happens with Disney, because I'm going to guarantee you in the next couple of years, they're going to be in a rough spot, because even, I mean, it's very apparent they're having trouble with Star Wars movies, which is not good.
It's wild to me that the studio that made a $300 million pirate movie and profited off of it can't make live-action movies that don't have superheroes in them. That's wild to me. Like, I saw the third Pirates movie when I was in, like, 8th or 7th grade, and I remember having my mind blown, and that same studio can't replicate that. It's crazy.
Well, I mean, look at The Flash. Look how long it took for us to get a Flash movie. And The Flash has been on TV and cartoon and live action for almost 20 years, maybe longer than that.
I think the other problem is that, like...
Well, it is longer because the OG TV show was in 91.
Yes. And then the Justice League cartoon, like, made him entirely feasible in cartoon form.
Yeah, which is why they should probably do Wally, because that's Wally.
Yes, it is. Wally's the man.
Like, stop doing Barry. Do Wally.
But I think that's the problem. And going back to Minions, I think that's the problem, is that just everybody's looking to recoup from the pandemic, so everybody just wants to put something out quick, because, like, I'm gonna be honest with you, if I was running WB right now, I'd be like, I don't care how much money you were losing on The Flash, we can't release this movie. Like, literally, something new comes out every single week. Like, the man was literally grooming and gaslighting children.
WB's in a weird position, because the Harry Potter's, like, basically dead because of the Fantastic Beasts franchise.
Shout out to WB coming out in support of J.K. Rowling this week, by the way, too.
this DC stuff is either hit or miss, because the next DC movie we're getting, I guess you could say Super Pets, but...
I thought that got pushed back.
No, that's this month.
Oh, wow. I don't know why I thought that got pushed back.
Oh, no, the movie that was supposed to come out this month, Black Adam's not coming out till October, which
that movie was supposed to come out when I was in high school.
Yeah, that movie's been in development for 20 years. That was right around the time, it was before Man of Steel. Like, The Rock was supposed to be Shazam, and then he moved to Black Adam because everybody told him you might be better for Black Adam.
And then they wanted John Cena to be Shazam, and then they ultimately went with my homie Zachary Levi.
And okay. And that's the thing, is, like, I feel bad for this Shazam movie because now it's opening like 4 or 5 days after Avatar 2. And every Christmas season, there'll be two or three or four blockbusters, and only one of them swims while the rest sink. And Avatar has a trailer out right now. That trailer's been playing in front of almost every movie.
Yes.
And playing in both 2D and 3D. And let me say this. The reaction so far has been very, very, very positive.
Yes.
I don't think it's a good idea that they should be putting out Shazam when it's coming out, just because they did the same thing last year with Matrix and Spider-Man, and we clearly saw what happened there.
I think Avatar 2 is going to be bigger than the first one for one sole reason that I just realized listening to you talk. It's been so long since the first one came out, that the people who saw the first one, because I was in high school when me and you saw the first one together. I'm 29 now, so everybody who was in high school with me, we all are either on our way to getting married or on our way to having kids or already have kids. So all those people are going to take their kids to see it.
I mean, not for nothing, too. I've made my feelings on that first movie clear. Like, I fucking hate it. I don't like anything about it, honestly. Like, visually, I thought it was okay. Like, everybody thought it was, like, a game changer. I'm like, nah, it's all right. I was like, visually, it was okay. And the story, I was like, you've seen it before. It's Pocahontas, it's Dancing with Wolves, it's Fern Gully. But this new one, the trailer for the new one, this teaser, is better than the entire first movie. Like, the movie can suck, and just alone visually, Because the visuals in this trailer are just mind-blowingly insane.
In hindsight, the first Avatar movie was just proof of concept for everything he wanted to do with the franchise, which I'm fine with, honestly, now. But again, this is in hindsight.
Because more and more, because, you know, over the past week, they've been putting out, revealing little more details about this sequel. Yeah. So I'm surprised, like, to hear who's playing who. I'm like, yes. Oh, that's who that is?
Yeah.
Oh, that's who that is? It's nuts. And, like, even seeing that trailer in IMAX, like, the texture of the skin, it looks like human skin on these Na'vi.
Yes, yes.
They put bags and wrinkles on Jake's face, which is insane to me.
You know, and it kind of makes me wonder, because, like, I think when I first launched and opened all those years ago, I showed you the video of in the Pandora part of Animal Kingdom and Disney World, they have animatronic Na'vi now. Because you remember that scene where Jake looks at one in a tank? They have one in a tank, and it actually moves and twitches in the tank. And, like, it's not, like, CG or anything. Like, they put an actual animatronic in a tank. And it's actual, like, clone Na'vi. And then on the ride, there's a Na'vi shaman who's singing and everything. I remember the first time I ever saw it, I got legitimately scared because I was like, that shit's real. And I remember, for me, it became, like, a little fun hobby for me around that time. Like, I would show people the video. They'd be like, nah, fuck that, bro. I'm like, yeah, right? That shit looks real.
Yeah, man. I'm not trying to see that shit in real life, to be quite honest with you.
Well, and that's the thing. I showed that to one of my friends. They're like, nah, you got to eat a brownie and go on that ride with me. I'm like, you're out of your fucking mind, dude.
Nah, look, if Na'vi were real, would I want to meet one? Sure. But as far as an animatronic park, where them shits are gonna, you be walking and one of them shits pops out, nah, I'm good.
And that's the thing, Disney's getting to the point where, like, if they want, they could just be like, hey, yo, James, you want some animatronics from the park to use in the fucking movies? Because, like, they have a Spider-Man animatronic that fucking swings now.
Yeah, but, I mean, why bother? Because these shits look fucking real. Like,
that's true.
In the trailer, like, I'm just like, how can I see... It's crazy that these fucking Na'vi have pores,
yes,
and their skin looks like my hand. Like, the close-up of the hand in that trailer, I'm just like, that's insane. There's just shots in that trailer where I'm just, yes, like when it has that, when the one Na'vi's gliding under the water with the whale,
yep,
and it's,
yep,
touching the surface of the water, I'm, yep, like, dog, that is more visually stunning than anything in the first movie. Like, yes, there's just stuff in that trailer where I'm just like, this is more, like, I never thought, when they first said, like, oh, yeah, the second one's going to take place in water and underwater, I'm like, that's fucking stupid. And then you see this trailer, you're like, oh, that makes a whole entire world of difference.
Yeah.
Because this is literally, like, a new world on the same planet we've,
yep,
already been. Like, yep, it's the creatures themselves, too. It's crazy.
I think James Cameron even said, like, we didn't see... Like, I think he said we only saw, like, 25% of Pandora in the first movie.
Yeah, so...
Because he said, like, that was just, like, one of the continents or some shit. I was like, there's other continents?
Yeah, so... Yeah, we'll see. All right, let's move on to another family-friendly movie. This one is one of the best movies of the year so far. It's A24's Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. If you guys are familiar with Marcel the Shell, he has a bunch of YouTube videos. It's by Jenny Slate, who voices Marcel, and Dean Fleischer Comp. He directed the movie in addition to, he also stars in it. He's the one making the documentary about Marcel.
Oh, that's dope.
Yeah, it's because the movie's about him, Dean, moves into an Airbnb because he split off with his wife. He's okay. Separating from his wife. And he discovers there's this walking, talking shell. Him and his grandma. So, like, he makes a whole documentary. And over the course of the documentary, it becomes about him and Marcel trying to find the rest of his family because the rest of his family got separated, which you'll see why. And it's just like, ooh, boy. I like that every scene in this movie has an emotional climax. And not only emotional climax, but emotional payoff. And it works for the overall narrative of the movie. The movie's only an hour and a half. There's no credit scene. So once the credits start rolling, well, there is a mid-credit. So after the mid-credit scene, you could dip. But, like, yeah, I love that. It's not long. It's only an hour and a half with credits. And I love it. Like, this movie, when I saw it, all the kids in the auditorium loved it. All the adults were crying. Like, I could hear almost every adult sniffling. This movie's awesome. It also shows how fake social media is, because when Marcel blows up and, you know, he's asking for help to find his parents, people start going to the house where he's at and start TikToking and Instagramming the house, and it starts fucking up Marcel's daily life, starts messing with his grandma. Dean has to fucking like close the shades because he wants privacy too. It gets crazy. Yeah. It's playing in a few cities and it's going to expand. A24 is giving it a rollout, like Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Okay.
So, man, A24 has been doing good this year, man.
You know, it's also interesting that like almost all the best movies this year are 2 hours or less.
Yeah. 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 Because Thor, which we'll get into shortly, is exactly, well, a minute shy of 2 hours.
And then The Princess was like an hour and 39 minutes, right?
Oh, yeah. That's what we'll get into next. All right. So, yeah, The Princess was an hour 25 with credits.
Really?
Yeah, without credits. Like, it was like an hour 25, hour 28 without credits. And, like, the credits are long.
Damn.
And there's no credit. There's no scene in the credits. So once the credits start rolling, you guys can shut it off. It's streaming on Hulu. For me personally, The Princess, I enjoyed it just because it does what it says on the box. It's Joey King killing a bunch of niggas trying to escape the tower. It's like a reverse rage. She's locked in it because, you know, the fairy tale is the princess gets locked in the tower and she's doing a reverse raid by escaping from the tower, and she's trying to save her kingdom and save her family because she's supposed to be married to this evil prince, lord, whatever this dude is. Yeah, Joey King's character is called The Princess. Everybody calls her The Princess. You don't find out her real name, which was cool.
Yeah, she's literally credited as The Princess.
So what'd you think?
I liked it. It was a lot of fun. It is, like you said, it's exactly what it is. I like Joey King a lot in the movie, too. And it's not like I dislike her or anything. It's just, like, I feel like she tends to do a lot of the same role.
Right, right.
So, like, she was, like, really, really good in this one. And something that's just, like, now dawning on me, like, I've been playing a lot of that video game called For Honor. And, like, I've been reading about knights here and there over the last 2 years. And, like, whenever she would fight, I was like, oh, she's actually in, like, the actual knight's fighting stance. I was like, I didn't expect a movie like this to actually have that sort of detail.
Well, Derek Kolstad is a producer on this. And for those of you who don't know, Derek Kolstad is the creator of John Wick. He wrote the first 3 John Wick movies. And he wrote Nobody.
I'm trying to think. What's the name of their him and what's his name? Homie who did Deadpool 2 and
David Leitch.
Yeah, they're because they did
Dissonant 78.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I feel like whenever their team's involved in something, the action is going to be good at worst, which is saying something.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I got nothing else to say. Like, Dominic Cooper's good in it. Olga Kurylenko's in this as her right man, the right hand henchwoman.
Oh, I can't remember the actress's name, but the one who played the woman who trained her, I know she's in that action or martial arts. I think it was a Korean film that got popular during lockdown called Fury.
Okay,
I need to watch that still. Yeah, I know she was in that, and she was also apparently in The Last Jedi.
Was she Rose's sister?
I guess so. Because I was trying to find who she played and I couldn't find it. I just saw she was credited in The Last Jedi.
Yeah. What came out first, The Last Jedi or Rogue One?
Rogue One. Yeah, it was Rogue One and then Last Jedi, yeah.
All right, so yeah, Last Jedi is literally like the last thing worthwhile from Star Wars. I do love the first season of The Mandalorian, but look where it led to.
I was going to say the first season of Mando.
It was great, but look what it led to. It led to all this.
And it's like I've told you multiple times, I legitimately think Kenobi's a great show. It would have been a better movie.
All right, now let's get into the thing you guys are all here for, which is Thor Love and Thunder. As you guys know, you've heard me and Jeff talk about this shit. Like, we are not down with Phase 4. Like, we like the TV shows. Some to varying degrees. There's a one I just flat out don't like, and it's now been made even worse by the movie that it tied into. Like Phase Four overall, I was just like, as far as the movies go, I've just been like, I was like, Spider-Man No Way Home clearly was head and shoulders above everything that's come. And thank God for Taika Waititi, because Taika Waititi, this movie is basically a romantic comedy. It is funny as shit, but it's also very romantic. He understands how to write characters first and foremost. Like Thor's arc in this, I love, because I related to it, just because my man's is trying to find himself. He's trying to be happy in general, and he's still dealing with some unresolved feelings with his ex. So they handle all of that very well in a 2-hour movie that still has the Guardians in it and still has other cameos that I'm not going to get into, because the cameos in this, unlike the cameos in Multiverse of Madness, play into the narrative and make sense. And if you've been watching the Thor movies from the beginning till now, you'll understand what I'm saying, where this is coming from. So, Thor Love and Thunder is basically, Thor is with the Guardians, and they're going from galaxy to going from, you know how they go around the galaxy saving people, because they are the Guardians of the Galaxy, and they happen upon a message from an old friend from Thor's past. So Thor breaks off and starts his whole investigation, and it leads to him coming across Gore the God Butcher. And Gore the God Butcher has been killing any and every god in his path. So Thor teams up with Valkyrie and Jane. And if you've seen the trailers, you'll know Jane is now the Mighty Thor. And Korg is with them, and these four go on an adventure across the galaxy to save the galaxy from the destruction of gods. Because if gods die, then, I mean, basically everybody else is next. If you've read the most recent run of where Jane was introduced as Thor, they adapt that, and they adapt it well, and it plays into the overall narrative of Thor's arc and even Jane's arc. And it makes sense why Jane, despite Natalie Portman not wanting to come back, and rightfully so, it makes it feel natural why she was missing from Ragnarok. Ragnarok is still to me better, but this is still great. Like, this is the second best Thor movie. I hope they keep Thor, Korg, and Valkyrie together as a team going forward. Yeah, it's very, very, this is so good. It, like, and Taika, like, the opening shot is just visually striking. I was like, oh, fuck, we're doing some Terrence Malick shit. I was like, fuck. The opening, before we get to the opening Marvel logo, which they do a metal version of, which is hilarious. The opening with Christian Bale and him and his whole motivations, I know that's probably going to be for a lot of people underserved, but for me, it worked so well because Christian Bale sold Gore and what Gore goes through in that opening. I was like, bro, this is one of the most fucked up openings for a Marvel movie I've ever seen. I mean, Jesus Christ, that shit was dark. So Gore, the God Butcher, you understand his motivation. You understand why he has pathos. He has weight to him, because every time he came on screen, he felt like a genuine threat. There's a sequence in this movie that's so visually striking where I'm just like, why can't more of these Marvel movies do this shit, man? Like, it is so, like, even everybody walked out of it talking about that sequence. Like, yo, that sequence was crazy. I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. I want to say it does suffer from having too much CG. You do tell when they're standing in front of CGI screens. However, unlike everything that's come out in Phase 4 where it just looks awful and cheap, here, it looks polished. It looks like they did the best they could. And I give, again, I credit Taika, because Taika knows how to do that well. And it's, besides Eternals, this is the best, well, Eternals and Loki, those are the best two looking Marvel projects so far in Phase 4. This is also joins that rank where it's now Love and Thunder, Eternals, and Loki as the best looking projects of Phase 4. Like, I could say the only other thing that comes close to looking this good in Phase 4 was Falcon and the Winter Soldier.
There's been some stuff in Miss Marvel where I'm like, for the story they're trying to tell, that's actually an impressive shot.
I like the first two episodes, the way they look, just because most of that is them on the street. Yeah. And it's nice to see them on the street.
I think Thor and Miss Marvel are making very good cases for why, if Marvel needs to keep making these during a pandemic, they have to go back to shooting on sets, just because like their pandemic CG ain't it. Cause like, I love No Way Home, but there are some parts where I'm like, dog, y'all are leaning on the CG way too heavily. Like, there's two, like, going back and rewatching it, there's a lot of parts now where I'm like, the CG suit on Tom Holland does not look as good as the real suits on Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire.
And that's why I'm saying, like, if it wasn't for the story and everybody acting,
yes,
like the acting, and then even John Watts.
I was going to say the acting, the writing, and the directing are really what make No Way Home. And that's why No Way Home feels like an actual movie.
Yeah, because it has a beginning, middle, and end.
Yes.
Even though it picks up right, like literally the second that Far From Home left off, it still feels like a beginning. Like that cliffhanger during that mid-credit scene for Far From Home, that felt like an ending, even though it's a cliffhanger. And here it picks it up immediately, but it still feels like a beginning.
It's also the first, now that we're talking about it, it's also, I'm realizing, the first post-credit scene that actually matters.
Yeah. Yeah, like, look, man. What I love about the Spider-Man trilogy is, like, well, Far From Home and No Way Home, those movies have consequences.
Yes.
Like, and it helps Peter's overall arc.
Yes.
Like, Peter is not the same character that he is from Homecoming at the end of No Way Home. Like, yeah. No Way Home, it feels like the end of his origin story.
And, like, in hindsight, in like, compared to everything we've seen this Peter go through, his first solo movie is so inconsequential.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's the problem with a lot of Phase 4. It just felt like Homecoming, where you're just like, oh, okay.
And which is wild, too, because, like, Homecoming has that dope-ass twist in it.
Yeah, but it's other than the twist, like, it's pretty forgettable.
And again, everything that works about that first movie is the acting and the directing. And even then, like, John Watts obviously gets more control over the feel and the look of each movie as with each one. So it's interesting to me that, like, we end up where we do with that Spider-Man just because of how he starts.
Yeah. Any questions on Thor, Love, and Thunder?
Is there really as much Guns N' Roses in the movie as people made it out to be?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. This has a lot of hair metal.
I'm fine with that because I actually like hair metal.
Yeah. The movie looks like an Iron Maiden album cover come to life. Like, all those metal album covers from, like, the 80s, like the 80s and 70s, like, this is the aesthetic of the movie.
And you can tell he was trying to do that with that first movie, because that whole opening was Surtur, and then when he's flying away from that dragon monster, he pulls out for the splash page shot where it's literally Thor flying away as a dragon's chasing him in like an alien planet hellscape. I'm like, yeah, the Taika has been trying to do this for a minute, so it's not too surprising that he finally got there.
Yeah, these are literally metal movies. Like, they're made for people, because, you know, back in the 70s and 80s,
yep,
metalheads were also known as stoners.
Yep.
And this is definitely, like, if you listen to a lot of metal and smoke a lot of weed, you're going to love this movie.
And it's interesting, too, because, like, I feel like a lot of what works with Taika's Thor movies come directly for him. And he very obviously has a very specific vision with his Thor movies compared to the rest of his movies. And I'm not saying he never has a vision with what he makes, because he always does. It's just like, you can tell that the same way John Watts was very obviously locked in on No Way Home, and the same way James Gunn is very locked in on his movies and his Guardians movies.
Well, even,
and I was going to say,
Suicide Squad.
And especially Peacemaker.
Yeah, the Suicide Squad, that whole movie is just stylized. Like, the way he moves the camera sometimes, yeah, I'm like, this is wild stylized.
Well, we talk about it all the time, that one shot in No Way Home where it's Peter and MJ finally getting into the apartment. Like, literally from the time Peter and MJ are caught in Peter's bedroom to, I think it's Happy.
Yeah, it's a Warner.
Yeah.
That's so, a Spielberg Warner,
yeah,
too.
Like, he does, like, a, I think that's, like, a full, like, two-minute scene, and it's a two-minute Warner, and you don't notice it.
Yeah. I think Natalie Portman's great in this. You could tell she cares just because she believes in the material, and she clearly is having fun.
You know, it's interesting, too, because she recently came out. She's like, I don't hate Thor the Dark World as much as everyone else does. I was like, huh!
Which is funny because she left because of that movie.
I think she mostly left because she was just disappointed in the fact that I think Natalie Portman was probably the first person to see where all these Marvel movies were going to go. And she's like, I'm just going to jump ship now. Because, like, think about it. Because, like, everybody now knows the story of how Patty Jenkins came in. She wanted to tell a very specific story. She wanted to shoot it in a very specific way. And, like, Natalie Portman fought to get Patty Jenkins on the project. And
that's why she signed on for Thor 2.
Exactly. So, like, she came back on this one knowing she wasn't going to be making a Marvel movie. She was making a movie.
It fucking sucks, too, because what Patty Jenkins wanted to do with Thor the Dark World, Taika really does here, which is the Romeo and Juliet love story. It's not Romeo and Juliet in this, but it is a love story, and it's two characters trying to come into grips with where they left off their relationship and where they are now in life, because they're both in, both Thor and Jane are in situations that they don't want to be in, but they still love each other, and that's very clear.
And I'm sure that's probably stuff like that Taika himself is dealing with, because he's dating now and he has kids from a previous relationship. So
so
obviously all these Marvel things work best when they're the director's film, and which is I think I said this to you recently, that I felt kind of insulted when Kevin Feige came out and said he wants more directors like Sam Raimi so he can step back. I'm like, dog, you're not the director, you're hiring these people to make the movie for you.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, despite my problems with Guardians of the Galaxy 2, I still like it, just because visually nothing's like that in the MCU. Same with the first one, same with Black Panther.
Yeah, yeah. The ones that work are clearly because of the directors. Like,
yes.
Everybody loved Cap because of the Russo brothers. Like, the Russo brothers came in and made Cap the character that he is. Just like now everybody's favorite character is Thor. Why? Because Taika came in and made that character who he is now.
And that's why the Guardians work so well, because
that's James Gunn.
And, like, despite like him writing the second one, like, you can very much tell, like, he even shares pictures of him on set with Nicole Perman on that first movie all the time. Like, he credits her every chance he gets, which I think is really dope, because I think he even said, he's like, a lot of the heart that grabbed me that I wanted to bring out more was from her. So I think it's literally like, you cannot make anything by committee, really. Too many cooks in the kitchen, that phrase is a thing for a reason. So I think, like, going forward, he's right. He has to step back because he's getting in his own way at this point.
It's interesting, too, because Black Panther is now the next and last movie of this phase. Well, not of this phase, but of the year. Joe Robert, yeah, that's it, Black Panther.
No, what's after, phase-wise, what's after?
I don't know. I think the last movie of the phase is going to be The Marvels, though. Or Fantastic Four, one of those.
Oh, no, they already straight up said Fantastic Four is not in a phase. They don't know. Yeah, they straight up said, we have no idea when this is coming out.
All right, so, yeah, I guess it's the Marvels. Black Panthers, Ryan Coogler brought back Joe Robert Cole to work on the script with him. So that's why it says written by Ryan Coogler and Joe Robert Cole.
And that, I think that's the other thing, is just because there's so many characters that have to go in so many different directions, I think a lot of these do need more than one writer. That's why I give props to James Gunn for Guardians 2, because he made all of those storylines work. Even though, like, again, I don't like Guardians 2 as much as the first one, but now in hindsight, compared to what we've been getting, like, a lot of what works in that is because he wrote it himself and he directed it himself.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, man. Yeah, I can't say anything more than just go see it in IMAX. Like, a lot of this was formatted in IMAX. Like, I wish the whole thing was in IMAX, just because Doctor Strange, the whole thing was in IMAX, and honestly, this deserves it more, because it's more visually arresting and there's more action. It's just a more satisfying movie.
Oh, so that was my other question, is like, so, because hearing you talk about the visuals, is what you said is like so the most visually impressive thing. Was it more impressive than the Valkyrie memory flashback thing? Because I remember like the way they shot that, that was all new technology. Like they, like Taika Waititi, he's like, yeah, I specifically went to one of my friends who like is really good with lights and lighting. And I was like, I described to him what I want to do. And then he built a whole lighting rig for me.
Yeah, nah, it comes close, but no, okay. But it does come close where you're just like, oh, this is cool.
Okay. All right.
You'll know it when you see it. This is not as weird as they made it out to be, like, yeah, at all. It's not that weird.
Yeah. Okay.
I was cracking up that Russell Crowe was yelling about space orgies. Like, I couldn't believe that made it into a Marvel film from Disney. You're not invited to the orgy!
Well, but that's the other thing, too, is because, again, going back to Black Panther and going back to Guardians, like, Star-Lord literally flips the bird in the first Guardians movie. Like, Black Panther has romance and is like low key horny.
He does talk about, and then Star Lord does talk about all the jizz. Yeah, fucking.
Yeah, and he talks about they make hella sex jokes in that. Like, they make fun of T'Challa for being horny for Nakia in the Black Panther movie. It's just like, it seems like whenever there's a director making it, it doesn't feel like a Marvel movie. It's just a movie.
What's cool too is this addresses, because I thought Valkyrie was attracted to Thor and Thor Ragnarok at some point, yes, but I always got the feeling like, oh, she's just straight gay. This movie confirms that she's bisexual.
I thought they always wanted her to be bisexual.
No, I know the first couple of drafts of Ragnarok, they were supposed to develop a relationship, and then Taiki is like, why are we doing this? Like, and so here, it's very much, she's very much into women. And when Thor is in the buff at one point of this movie, everybody is in shock and everybody's like gawking and just all like, oh, that's, yeah, yeah. Even the men are just like, yeah. And it's funny looking when it cuts back to Korg, Valkyrie, and Jane, even Valkyrie's sitting there like, yeah, yeah. And I was just like, oh, okay.
And I think a reason why that works really well is because, like, I agree with what Mike Myers recently came out and said, because people were talking about, were asking him questions about Austin Powers, because he has some new Netflix movie that came out that I haven't watched. Or it might be a show, but whatever. And he said something that I really agreed with and found really interesting. He was like, I always thought sexiness in movies to me was inherently funny, just because the whole concept of sex appeal and sexuality to me has a base of comedy to it, just because like you are literally dressing yourself and acting an entirely different way just to have sex with someone. I'm like, yeah, that is inherently funny. And the fact that like people are just so scared to put that in movies now because we just don't talk about it. I'm like, we're afraid to talk about something that's so trivial. So yeah, that I think that's why what you're describing works so well, just because like we don't see it that well and it's taken both seriously and comically.
Yeah, I mean, I could go on about that whole thing, but that's an entirely different show that has nothing to do with movies. Yeah. So with that,
we're the Film Blurred. I'm Brandon Nord, and I'm the motherfucking protagonist.
I'm the protagonist.
I'm Jeff Stewart, a.k.a. He Who Remains.
Don't come at us. It's just fucking movies.
You've been listening to the Film Blurs podcast.
Man, I just love what you guys do, man.
I never miss an episode. It's the best.
It's my favorite podcast.
Follow Jeff on IG on MindFireXL and Brandon on Twitter at BJNTweets.